We now come to the 10th president of the United States. We are looking at each of the presidents each time we get together here. This is an election year, and so we're looking at the spiritual lives of the presidents. If we have any information concerning this, we try to get that to you. So today it's John Tyler, and he's actually best known for being the first president to serve without being elected to office. And he served nearly an entire term of 4 years after President William Henry Harrison died just 32 days after taking office. Well, he had graduated from the College of William and Mary in 1807. And after graduation, he studied law and began to practice law after passing the bar in 1809. And as we've looked at these, what are sometimes called fun facts concerning the presidents each time we get together, we see that before he became president, he had entered politics at a very young age, 21, and he was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, another Virginian here, and his political career continued to rise over the years as he was elected to the United States House of Representatives, governor of Virginia, and the U.S. Senator from Virginia. John had long been a member of the Democrat Party, but split with them over some of President Andrew Jackson's policies. And so he joined the Whig Party, which was for strong states' rights. In 1840, he's selected by the Whigs to run as vice president with William Henry Harrison in order to get that Southern vote. And Harrison's nickname was Tippecanoe because of that battle that he had been very successful in, and the campaign slogan was Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Well, they won the election over the incumbent Martin Van Buren. Well, President Harrison got a terrible cold during his long inauguration speech, and his cold turned into pneumonia, and he died 32 days later. And this caused some confusion as the U.S. Constitution was unclear as to exactly what should happen when the president died. Tyler, however, took control, became president. He assumed all the powers of president as well as the title. And later we, as a country, have the 25th Amendment that would describe the succession to the presidency so that there would not be any further confusion. Well, when he became president, he did not fall in line with the party, the Whig Party politics. He disagreed with them on several issues, and as a result, they kicked him out of the party, and all but one of the cabinet members resigned. They even tried to impeach him, saying that he misused his veto power, and that impeachment failed, however. Tyler was a strong proponent of states' rights, and that meant that he thought state governments should have more power and the federal government less power. And states should be able to set their own laws without the federal government interfering. His policies regarding states' rights caused a further rift and separation between the northern and southern states, and this likely had some influence and helped to cause the Civil War. And he was involved, some of the accomplishments is he signed the Log Cabin Bill, which gave settlers the right to claim land before it was for sale and then buy it later for $1.25 an acre. And this helped to get the West settled and expand the country. He also worked on the annexation of Texas. He worked for that. It became part of the United States. A tariff bill. He signed a tariff bill that helped to protect northern manufacturers and the Canadian border dispute. The Webster-Ashburton Treaty helped to end a border dispute with the Canadian colonies along the Maine border. Well, after leaving the presidency, Tyler retired to Virginia. He began to think that the South should secede from the United States. And when the Civil War began and the South formed the Confederate States, he became a member of the Confederate Congress. Tyler had always been somewhat sickly, and as he grew older, he continued to fail in his health, and it is thought that finally he died from a stroke. And so we have this man who comes into the presidency in such a way. In fact, he gained a nickname called His Accidency, because he was one that basically stepped into the presidency in a way that no one else had ever done before. Well, I'm reading from Gary May's book, John Tyler. It says, on April 9th, 2 days after Harrison's funeral, the new president issued what some called an inaugural address. Although Tyler never described it as such, he realized that it was necessary to inform the country of his principles. He had not conferred with Harrison prior to his death, and the suddenness of events deprived Tyler of the views of his closest friends. Therefore, he decided to follow the light of my own judgment and the prompting of my own feelings. President Tyler's address, as it was called by the press, was brief and vague, addressed to his fellow citizens. He first expressed his great regret over the death of President Harrison, an occurrence that subjected the wisdom and sufficiency of our institutions to a new test. Never before had the office of the presidency, because of an unforeseen contingency, devolved upon the vice president, but that is what the Constitution required. As president, he would carry out the principles of that Constitution, which I have sworn to protect, preserve, and defend. By explicitly stating that he had inherited the office, Tyler undercut those who believed that he was only the acting president. Although a few legislators raised questions about Tyler's legitimacy, both the House and the Senate later formally recognized his lawful right to the office. So specifically, Tyler promised a foreign policy that would do justice to all nations while submitting to injustice from none. He urged the creation of a stronger, more efficient army and navy to ensure that the honor of the country sustain no blemish. His remarks reflected concern over recent tensions between Britain and the United States. He also would recommend policies to deal with the spoil system. And as for fiscal programs, Congress would formulate them, but he alone would determine if they were constitutional. In concluding, he promised to work to preserve unimpaired the free institutions upon which we live, relying on the intelligence and patriotism of the people, as well as an ever watchful and overruling providence. And so we see little segments, little snippets of the idea of him being one that believed in the providence of God, as most people at that time did. The whole idea of, though, the vice president sometimes is looked at as one that doesn't seem to have very much power. But when what happened, he steps into a role that he takes on power. So when William Henry Harrison died, Tyler rose to the presidency, and he had a regard for his deceased predecessor. And back in that inaugural address, that Tyler's address, he commented, "While standing at the threshold of this great work, he has, by the dispensation of an all-wise providence, been removed from amongst us, and by the provisions of the Constitution, the efforts to be directed to the accomplishing of this vitally important task have devolved upon myself." And so he's basically saying in this address, and I get this from the book, The Faith of the Presidents, John M. Wiley, he concluded his address saying, "I beg you to be assured that I shall exert myself to carry the foregoing principles into practice during my administration of the government, and confiding in the protecting care of an ever watchful and overruling providence, it shall be my first and highest duty to preserve unimpaired the free institutions upon which we live, and transmit them to those who shall succeed me in their full force and vigor." And so Tyler was an Episcopalian and seemed to understand God as sovereign and involved in creation. And we see that just 4 days after his inauguration, he called on the country to a national day of prayer and fasting. He urged, "When a Christian people feel themselves to be overtaken by a great public calamity, it becomes them to humble themselves under the dispensation of divine providence, to recognize his righteous government over the children of men, to acknowledge his goodness in time past, as well as their own unworthiness, and to supplicate his merciful protection for their future. Undoubtedly, in the time of calamity like today, Tyler's words are highly worth pondering. He even said in his fourth annual message to Congress, he declared, "Our prayer should evermore be offered up to the Father of the universe for his wisdom to direct us in the path of our duty so as to enable us to consummate these high purposes," which he had defined as guaranteeing various freedoms for Americans, such as freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, as well as retaining trials by jury and holding fast to the doctrine of habeas corpus. So we see that he's understanding that there's more to this life than just what we would see. And so he received even a letter. This tells you that he had a diverse look at religion and spirituality, because he received this letter from this Jewish American, and I get this from the book, The Presidents and Their Faith, by Grinder and Shaw, this Jewish American, Jacob Ezekiel of Richmond, Virginia, in which he asked Tyler for an explanation. "As we may meet the views of those who do not profess Christianity through believers in the supreme being of the world." And so this is what the President Tyler replied, "For the people of whom you are one, I can feel none other than profound respect. The wisdom which flowed from the lips of your prophets has in time past and will continue for all time to come to be a refreshing fountain of moral instruction to mankind, while holy records bear witness of divine favors and protection of the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, God of the Christian and the Israelite, to his chosen people. May I then hope, sir, that this explanation will remove all difficulties, and that your voice and the voices of all your brethren shall ascend to our common Father in supplication and prayer on the day that I have suggested." We see Tyler later in his one-term presidency presenting a perspective on politics and religion in this young republic. He said this, "The United States have ventured upon a great and noble experiment, which is to believe to have been hazarded in the absence of all previous precedent, that of total separation of church and state. No religious establishment by law exists among us. The conscience is left free from all restraint, and each is permitted to worship his maker after his own judgment. The Mohammedan, if he were to come along among us, would have the privilege guaranteed to him by the Constitution to worship according to the Quran. And the East Indian might erect a shrine to Brahma if it so pleased him. Such is the spirit of toleration inculcated by our political institutions. The Hebrew persecuted and downtrodden in other region takes up his abode among us with none to make him afraid." So, in the words of John Meacham, as the United States grew even more diverse, visions like Tyler's became ever more relevant. Well, in 1813, going back, Tyler had married a fellow Virginian and a devout Episcopalian, Letitia Christian, with whom he had 8 children. One of their daughters, Elizabeth, was married on January 31st, 1842, in the East Room of the White House. 8 months later, though, the president's wife died of complications from a series of strokes. Less than 3 years later, Tyler married again. His new bride, Julia Gardiner, was 22, and Tyler was 55. And that wedding took place at the Church of the Ascension in New York City. They had 7 children together, one of whom, Lyon Gardiner Tyler, would later become president of the College of William and Mary. And after Tyler's death in 1862, his wife became a convert to Catholicism. Well, like his political hero, Thomas Jefferson, Tyler was an ardent expansionist, and he was a strong advocate of states' rights. And while holding to the view that slavery was a profound moral blight on the country, he also owned slaves. And like the master of Monticello, he left behind black people claiming descent from him. So after his presidency, Tyler was an active member of the Virginia Convention that led the state's secession from the Union. And later, he, as I already mentioned, was elected to the Confederate House of Representatives. Well, he died on January 18th, 1862, prior to taking office. And many at the time considered Tyler our first traitor president for his aggressive support of and involvement with Confederate policy. Well, we look back and we see that once he wrote to his daughter, "The person who is a stranger to sickness is equally a stranger to the highest enjoyments of health. So I have brought myself to believe that the variableness in the things of the world is designed by the Creator for the happiness of his creatures. The person who justly contemplates the wise order of providence can alone possess a just idea of the deity." And according to Meacham, like Jefferson, he was a kind of deist who believed that reason offered rewards. Like Lincoln, he was somewhat stoic. Well, he's buried with Episcopal rites in a Book of Common Prayer ceremony in Richmond, Virginia. So we don't know, however, much about the depth or extent of his own personal religious beliefs and practices. He was said to have possessed an impressive, wide-ranging knowledge of Scripture, yet we have no record of his own religious views. And there is uncertainty about him being a full member in the Episcopal Church. So this is, once again, a president that we don't know concerning where he stood. And that happens quite often, but that happens with regular old people too. So that's where we stand with John Tyler.